in which the theme of the broadcast is, I don't think the federal budget works the way you think the federal budget works, sir. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 12th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to state as fact here as we get going that the fiscal year 2019 budget the White House released today is not what you might call, in Washington parlance, an operative fiscal policy document. You think all the way back to last week, and you will remember that Congress has already hammered out a spending plan for the next 2 years. So there is that. But if you give the administration's budget a read, there are some interesting things that jump out at you, especially some of the assumptions the White House is making, including perhaps the most fundamental one, that they think the economy is going to grow at 3% or more a year for the next decade. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer gets us going.
The Trump administration needs the economy to grow at roughly 3% for the next 10 years, or there won't be enough money to cover all of its spending on things like the tax cut, not to mention the new approximately $4 trillion budget. The chances of getting that kind of growth?
Very, very unlikely.
Rudy Penner is a former head of the Congressional Budget Office.
Some people expect a kind of sugar high from the tax cut, which could certainly boost growth in 2018 and maybe slip over to 2019 as well.
But then, Penner and other economists say, growth will slow down for a number of reasons. Baby boomers are retiring, and there aren't enough people coming into the workforce to replace them. Possible cuts to immigration will make the labor market even tighter. And the president could pull the U.S. out of NAFTA. Veronique de Rougie is an economist at the Mercatus Center.
And it would send a signal that trade may be harder, doing business could be more expensive.
Plus, interest rates are poised to rise to keep inflation in check. Louis Alexander, chief economist at Nomura Securities, says the higher interest rates will be a kick in the gut for the economy.
Well, it makes it more expensive for businesses to borrow to invest. It makes it more expensive for consumers, frankly, to buy homes or buy cars or any number of things.
And when things get more expensive, consumers buy less. Another problem, Alexander says, businesses and consumers will be competing for loans with the federal government, which will have to borrow ever more money to cover our growing national debt. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Speaking of that debt, by the by, one more tidbit from the fine print of the president's budget, courtesy of Kimberly Adams in our Washington bureau. She did the digging. For budget year 2026, we are going to be spending $755 billion on discretionary defense spending. That is the Pentagon. Also, $784 billion just in interest on the money we are borrowing. All right, moving on. Entry number two in today's Chronicles of Federal Budgeting is hard. Infrastructure. The Trump administration's long-awaited plan to fix, overhaul, or otherwise repair everything from waterways to highways to commercial space infrastructure. Well, it came out today, about which, a couple of things. First of all, despite what you might be seeing and hearing, it is not a $1.5 trillion government plan. It's $200 billion in federal seed money that the White House is offering, hoping others will pony up, which gets us to point number two. Where is the rest of that money going to come from? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is on that one.
On the face of it, the president's plan has a math problem. How to turn $200 billion into $1.5 trillion.
It flips the current kind of funding paradigm on its head.
Michael Sargent is a policy analyst for transportation and infrastructure at the Right-Leaning Heritage Foundation. Normally, he says, the federal government would cover half to 80% of large infrastructure projects.
Whereas this program would cover a maximum of 20%.
It favors projects that can find other sources of revenue, and it basically says to states, you figure it out.
It's the same kind of magical thinking that would have the president say, we'll build a wall in another country, we'll pay for it.
Rosabeth Moss Kanter is a professor at Harvard's Business School and advised Hillary Clinton on infrastructure. She says states can't afford it, so they are likely to look at the two places they've already been looking.
Tolls and the gas tax.
Scott Greenberg is executive editor of Pew's Stateline.
26 states have raised their gas taxes in the past 4 years. Many states are now creating new toll roads.
Asking states to raise more money is an ironic twist, says Brookings' Aaron Klein. He says the recently passed tax bill eliminates the state and local tax deduction, which makes any new taxes particularly unpalatable. It also raises the cost of municipal bonds.
At the same time, the new infrastructure proposal is asking more of state and local governments to bring more money to the table. The tax bill is making it harder for them to get that money.
All this is to say it may be a stretch to turn $200 billion into $1.5 trillion. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, I'm glad you asked. Nothing wrong with traders. A couple of days off can't fix, I'll tell you that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's opioid news today of the corporate variety. Purdue Pharma, which makes the blockbuster opioid painkiller OxyContin, has sent a letter to doctors saying that Purdue's sales reps aren't going to visit anymore to try to sell them on opioids, which, for a drug company known for its aggressive marketing, is a big deal. Also, over the weekend, there were reports that Purdue is cutting its sales staff by more than 50%, with the people who are left focusing on non-painkiller medications. Marketplace's Caitlin Esch and our podcast, The Uncertain Hour, spent 8 months investigating Purdue Pharma and the regulatory roots of the opioid epidemic in this country. So we got her back in to talk about the news of the day. Caitlin, good to have you in the studio.
Nice to be here.
Tell us why this is happening now with Purdue Pharmaceuticals, would you?
Purdue released a very short statement, so we don't really know why now. But some say that this is too little too late. I mean, since 1995, more than 350,000 people have died from overdoses involving opioids.
Right.
The numbers for 2016 came out recently, and it was the deadliest year on record. So the problem just seems to be getting worse and worse. But it is still a significant, if symbolic, move. I mean, as far as I know, no other opioid maker has made an announcement like this, though some have sort of slowly stopped pushing opioids aggressively.
Let me ask you, based on what you guys reported in The Uncertain Hour, that hour you did, that you and I talked about it, what was the marketing campaign, right? We'll get to the regulations in a minute, which was the focus of what you guys did. But what was the marketing push for OxyContin?
The marketing campaign was described by the DEA as inappropriate, aggressive, and unprecedented. So Purdue was really good at pushing its product, OxyContin, through many different ways. I mean, there was OxyContin swag that they gave out, fishing hats,
like, really?
Pedometers,
wow.
Stuffed animals.
Pedometers?
Music CDs. All expense paid conferences at resorts for doctors, you know, and sales reps would visit doctors and pharmacists to promote OxyContin. And the centerpiece of the marketing campaign were really these claims about OxyContin's abusability and addictiveness.
Which gets us to the regulatory environment. Refresh us, remind us what that was and why it's so critical to this entire, addiction issue.
Right. You really have to look at the regulations that brought OxyContin to market more than 20 years ago. Drug companies can't make claims about a drug if those claims aren't backed up by the label, the package insert. And that is a long and detailed document that gives information about side effects, warnings, clinical studies, that kind of thing. So sales reps would point to a couple of sentences in the label that indicated OxyContin was less addictive and less abusable than other opioids.
And that was the key point with this particular medication from Purdue Pharmaceuticals, right?
Yeah. I mean, Purdue knew that doctors would be concerned about addiction and abuse. I mean, these are painkillers that we're talking about, opioid painkillers. They also knew from focus group reports that if they could sort of convince doctors that this drug was a little bit safer than other opioids, that would really help sell the drug.
Right. So we should be clear here. The news is that Purdue's going to stop marketing to physicians, not going to stop selling it. That's not the issue.
Right.
What then is the future for Purdue Pharmaceuticals and the larger market here?
Well, it'll be interesting to see if other opioid makers sort of follow Purdue's lead and stop marketing their opioids. It's interesting. Some insurance companies have said that they are no longer going to cover OxyContin. And 14 states and hundreds of cities and counties are suing Purdue and other opioid makers over their role in the opioid epidemic. And a lot of that comes back to marketing and the way that these opioids were marketed to doctors, which is what Purdue is no longer going to do.
Caitlin Esch, it's a podcast called The Uncertain Hour. She did it with Chrissy Clark and Maria Honhorst as well. I cannot recommend it highly enough, especially this episode on opioids. Caitlin, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You know, credit scores, right? That honestly somewhat mysterious number that ostensibly is about how likely you are to pay your debts, but then in reality has been adapted for use in hiring decisions or whether or not a landlord will rent to you, all kinds of different things. China is building something that goes a good deal further. It's called the social credit system. And by 2020, the government in Beijing hopes to be able to collect not just financial information on its citizens, but also to record antisocial behavior. Things like not sorting your garbage or refusing to visit your parents. And just like credit scores here, over there, it's kind of mysterious too. Our China correspondent Jennifer Pack reports now from Shanghai.
In China, if a court orders you to repay debts and you refuse, a judge may put you on a blacklist. And when friends call you, instead of a ringtone, they might hear.
The person you have reached is listed by the local court as a discredited person.
China's Supreme Court runs this blacklist. Since 2013, there have been 9.5 million people put on the list. Journalist Liu Hu is one of them. He lost a defamation lawsuit and was ordered to pay compensation and other fees.
I wired the money to the wrong account, so the court didn't get the money. No one there told me. Then the court put me on the blacklist.
He and others on the blacklist are banned from boarding a plane or high-speed train.
Since I couldn't fly across the country for a work trip, I ended up taking the slow train. Instead of a 3-hour flight, it took me 28 hours to get there.
The court also restricts him from making big purchases, like buying property or sending his kid to private school. Anyone with Liu Hu's name and ID number can check the blacklist through the Supreme Court's website. The blacklist shows the kinds of penalties people deemed untrustworthy might get once the database is set up by 2020. Credit expert Hu Naihong says the goal of the project is simple.
Those with good credibility will be rewarded. Those with bad credibility will be punished.
And dozens of cities are also testing their own systems. Shanghai is one of them. Here, if you jaywalk or don't sort your garbage properly, the local government might record these infractions on your credit file. This may seem odd to Americans, but some in China say it's necessary. Again, credit expert Hu Naihong.
You can't say people damage their credit only after they default on their debts. There may have been many clues in their daily lives that show that they don't like to follow rules.
She says the central government has not assigned any social credit scores to its citizens yet, and it's not clear who will calculate it and how social behaviors will be factored in. So what if you want to dispute what's on your social credit file? Li Xiaolin, a well-known lawyer, tried. In 2014, he was sued for defamation. He lost, and a judge ordered him to make an apology, which Li Xiaolin submitted in writing. 10 months later, he found out he was blacklisted. It took him another 3 weeks before an official told him why.
The court said my apology was not sincere. I asked officials, how did they judge that?
Eventually, Li Xiaolin wrote a second apology, and the court removed him from the blacklist in 2016. Then last year, he tried to get a credit card.
The bank denied my application, so I figured out that the bank might still have my name blacklisted. And I was right.
The bank updated its records the next day, but by that point, he had spent almost a year to fully clear his name. Still, he's considered one of the luckier ones. Journalist Liu Hu says he transferred money to the court. This time it was successful, but a judge said the amount needs to be increased by at least $1,000.
Basically, it's very hard to find information on how to resolve my case. I've only gotten this far because I have some contacts.
For now, Liu Hu is still on the blacklist, which the Chinese state media refers to as the list of lao lai, or deadbeats. He's still trying to get off it. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Do people actually want to compost? Like, maybe I don't have to work quite so hard at, like, trying to convince them that this is a good idea.
And a good business, too. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 1.7% today, 410 points, 24,601 on the blue chips. NASDAQ gained 1.5%, 107 points, 69.81. The S&P 500 picked up 1.3%, about 36 points, 26 and 56 there. OPEC is raising its supply forecast for this year, even as growing global demand continues to gobble up whatever excess crude supply is out there right now. ExxonMobil up 0.8%. Today, Chevron rose 0.4%. Royal Dutch Shell notched up 1.5% today. Shares of Oracle picked up 0.8% today on news it's expanding its space in the cloud. Shares of Amazon, the cloud leader, gained 3.4% today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.86%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Among the skating rinks and the bobsled tracks and the ski slopes of the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang right now stands something completely different. The darkest building on the planet, thanks to a high-tech new color of sorts that it's been painted with. It's a little bit art installation, a little bit commerce as well. It's a pavilion sponsored by Hyundai. Cassia St. Clair is a design journalist, also the author of a book called The Secret Lives of Color. So we called her up to talk about this substance. It's called Vantablack VBX2.
Yes, so the VBX2 is kind of a spin-off of the original product, which is called Vantablack. And Vantablack is this incredible ultra-black nanostructure that can be kind of grown onto various different surfaces. And the VBX2 is a kind of spray paint version. And what this allows people to do is to apply it over a much wider area. And it's a little bit more user-friendly, I guess you'd say. But the effect is the same. It's this incredible, very deep, matte, ultra-black that absorbs over 99% of available light.
So there is this pavilion, this building at the Olympic Park in Pyeongchang. What are they doing with it? And the flip side then is, it's not like I'm going to use this to paint my bedroom, right?
Not yet.
Okay,
VBX2, while it is much more user-friendly, as I said, is still a little bit of a tricky thing to work with. And I know the team who've created this one pavilion have had all sorts of technical difficulties trying to make it last and give the effect for the full sort of 6 weeks period that the pavilion will be up. But the pavilion itself is designed by this architect called Asif Khan, who's a British architect. And his term was as punctuation, particularly when we are just sort of surrounded by light and kind of almost bombarded by it, right. 24 hours a day. By its absence, we can create this sense of wonder and magic around light.
The Olympics being, I guess, as commercialized as they are nowadays, we have to point out that Hyundai is sponsoring this pavilion in order to promote like a fuel cell powered car or something, right? I mean, there's commerce behind this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think when you hear about something that is ultra black, it's very, very hard to conceptualize it. I myself have only seen a very small sample of it just on a piece of tin foil in a lab where they create it in the south of England. Yes, you immediately think, what would this be like sort of on a larger scale? But it is very difficult to wrap your head around it. It's a very uncanny material because it plays with your sense of depth perception, because you can't see exactly how close or far away the material is. So it's really quite an incredible thing to see that at such a large scale.
Cassia St. Clair, you've heard her elsewhere on the program. Her book is called The Secret Lives of Color. She is also by day a design journalist. Cassia, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
All right. That was lovely. Yeah. Now I want to see this stuff.
I'm desperate to go out and see it. I follow the creator on Instagram, and he's been sort of out in Korea taking lots of videos and things. And it is just the most astounding thing to see it kind of at that scale, even through my iPhone screen. not quite the same, but
excellent.
I'm desperate to go out and see it.
Thanks very much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
With apologies to Benjamin Franklin, there is indeed nothing certain in life except death and taxes and waste. Straight up consumer waste, yes. Also food waste, a lot of it in this country. So much so that a lot of cities have launched municipal composting programs, offering to pick up food waste alongside the standard trash and recycling bins. Thing is, in a lot of areas, general trash collection doesn't exist, let alone composting services. So as Brita Green reports now from Western New Hampshire, entrepreneurs are seeing some profit in other people's table scraps.
With her MBA in hand, Jessica Satterley Hall knew she wanted to start her own business, and she got hooked on the concept of compost. She knew food scraps produce significantly more methane when tossed in a landfill instead of breaking down in compost, and methane's a greenhouse gas. So she thought, what if you could somehow reward people for separating their food waste from their trash?
And so I did a bunch of financial models around, like, trying to pay people for their compost. And I just was looking at it every which way, and I was like, I don't know.
She decided to take a step back, asking a simpler question.
Do people actually want to compost? Like, maybe I don't have to work quite so hard at, like, trying to convince them that this is a good idea.
She looked at surveys nationally and did some locally, here in New Hampshire and neighboring Vermont. She found that about 65% of people were willing to compost if it wasn't too hard and didn't cost them more than they're currently paying to get rid of their waste. That figure struck her as high. 65% of people? Now that could be a customer base.
Go, car, go, go.
About 6 months later, she's fully operational as the Upper Valley Compost Company. Today, she's navigating up a slippery and steep country road.
There we go.
She has two services. She charges $20 a month for a weekly curbside pickup, where she takes a bucket full of food scraps, meat and dairy too, and leaves you a fresh bucket in its place.
Clean bucket, clean top.
For half that, you can drop off your own bucket at a local grocery store. Just like many trash collectors, she doesn't break down the waste herself. She pays to drop it off at other facilities. But the model's working. She's already at a point where she's considering hiring her first employee to keep up with demand.
Yeah. So we actually have had people tell us that they're canceling their trash service.
Weekly trash pickup out here costs about $45 a month. That's more than double the Upper Valley Compost Company's price. So some of her customers are starting to skip the service and bring their garbage to the dump themselves. Now that there's no food waste rotting in their garbage, they don't have to go very often. Plus, some of Satterley Hall's customers had been trying to compost on their land, but they were tired of attracting animals, and most notably, bears.
The bears have a path right along this fence.
Dan Collison, one of her customers, walks me through his yard.
We've seen them 4 or 5 times. I have some good footage, including one of the little cubs trying to pry the lid off the compost bin.
Even in places where bears might not be sniffing at your back door, community-scale composting businesses are increasingly cropping up. That's according to Brenda Platt, who studied composting nationally with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit that promotes economic and environmental sustainability.
Food waste has gotten so much attention in the last few years.
She says more and more people are realizing the benefits of compost, and some states are even starting to require food scraps be separated. That's driving new business and innovation. Satterley Hall's now wondering whether she could market her service anywhere and contract with local drivers who could be assigned customers and a route. Or, in startup speak,
create a technology that allows anybody with a car to be a hauler.
And there's plenty of food waste that needs to be disposed of. The EPA says more food is thrown out in everyday trash than any other single material. The agency has set a goal to reduce that waste by half over the next 12 years. In Lebanon, New Hampshire, I'm Brita Green for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, as seen in the pages of the Wall Street Journal today, if you are a male of a certain age in this economy, Social Security might be killing you. The paper highlighted a study out in the Journal of Public Economics last month. The deal is this: the 10% of men in this country who retire at 62 could be looking at a 20% or greater probability of death than a guy who keeps on working. One of the things the study points out that lets people retire at 62, Social Security. Yes, it's more complicated than 30 seconds on the radio, which is why we put the whole link to the piece on our website, marketplace.org. All right, we're leaving. The Dow Industrial's up 1.7% today, about 410 points. NASDAQ gained about 1.5%, 107 points. S&P 500 picked up 1.3%, 36 points there. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. The aforementioned Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.